This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And are you ready to put your predictions to the test? Well, with Interactive Brokers Forecast Trader, you can trade your views on key economic and climate indicators. Simply answer yes or no. For example, will the change in the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.6%? Or maybe will the average U.S. temperature in 2024 be greater than 54 degrees? If you agree, buy a yes contract. If you don't, buy a no. It's that easy. Contracts cost $2 to $0.99, and correct predictions earn $1 at settlement. And incorrect ones, well, they settle at zero. Forecast contracts are commission-free, plus earn 4.08% APY on your investment with an incentive coupon. Visit ibkr.com/forecast and make your predictions today. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Bitcoin, well, it breaks out finally. Markets seem a little toppy, but the trend is still intact. Everybody's talking about the Santa rally. Is it going to happen again? And our guest today is John Pugliano from Wealthsteading Podcast. All this and much more on episode number 898 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bang, zoom to the moon. Bitcoin finally takes flight, right? I mean, we get over that 100,000, zoomed up to 104,000. Was that on Wednesday? I guess it was. And then just backed off dramatically. That's interesting. I mean, there was a lot of overhead resistance, that psychological number, that the psychological resistance points of round numbers, right? You get those round numbers, whether it's 100 or 1,000 or 500, whatever those round numbers that it hasn't gotten to before, and all of a sudden it becomes this psychological number that everybody's like, well, it's going to get there. And then when it does, it kicks back a little bit. And that's exactly what happened here. But what is the reason for that? Well, I think some of it is due to the fact that we have a rather market-friendly cabinet, that picks that are going in, whether or not all will get approved or not is another discussion. But we have recent announcement, for example, Atkins for the SEC chair, that is known for being a much friendlier and supportive individual for cryptocurrencies than clearly Gary Gensler was. But you got to give Gary Gensler a little bit of credit, because he was on the watch when it was really first starting to become, not first, but when it was becoming something that had to be potentially regulated. And that was something that had to be dealt with and sorted through and analyzed and looked at from every angle to make sure that investors weren't going to get screwed. In fact, I would say that the Atkins nomination for SEC chair appointment, if you will, is really what happened. That would seem to prompt the move from Bitcoin from 95,000 to 104,000. It pretty much happened exactly on the announcement. It took about a day to go through the entire process, but that's what happened. Now, what's going to see what happens now? There's a lot of leverage in the system when it comes to Bitcoin from companies like MicroStrategy, for example. We saw what happened there, of course, that went up. But that could have been a harbinger of what was going to happen next, because even as Bitcoin was breaking up, MicroStrategy was turning lower. That was interesting. People were taking profits on it. Something to consider. If you don't know by now, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of this podcast. I'm also the co-host of DH Unplugged. My Twitter handle, I want to make sure you got that. We haven't talked about that in a while, is Andrew Horowitz. That's it. Andrew Horowitz, one word. Follow me on Twitter. Make sure you do that, because what you'll get is some items every so often that we send out regarding to stocks, the economy, but more so, you're going to get firsthand when the podcast is published. As soon as that podcast is published, bang, it hits Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it. And you're going to have instant access to that. So make sure to do that. I am also the founder and I guess chief of investments here at Horowitz a company. If you're looking for somebody to help you with your investments, that's something we do on a regular basis. In fact, that's what we do all the time. That's the truth. We're helping people with their investments all the time, managing it so you can go along doing what you do best, and we handle what we do best. This week, I had a really nice conversation. I was the guest on Frank Curzio's Wall Street Unplugged podcast this week. It was fun. We have a good time together. What I liked most about it was we had the opportunity to showcase, I mean, you don't see a lot of it because it's just the camera, it's a background, all that, but utilize all of the equipment in the new studio that we built out. So check that out when it comes out. Look up Wall Street Unplugged podcast. You'll find that on YouTube and a lot of other places. There's video, so I think it looks pretty good. One of the things that Frank and I discussed, I thought was really quite a very interesting discussion. We talked about retail. We talked about how hard it is, impossible to go against and to bet against the U.S. consumer. Almost as hard these days as it is to bet against the markets, right? It just keeps going up. The consumer just keeps on buying. I mean, we've seen some pretty amazing numbers. And when it comes down to people, you'll find, and especially now, where we are exactly now in this, what would she say? A post-apocalyptic COVID, post-pandemic world that people want to live their life to the fullest. YOLO. Spend now, save for later. But make our money work for us as hard as we can is the balance that we need to achieve. Let me say that again because I think it's really important. The idea that people are looking to spend now experiential types of spending over material items, but material is still important. And then on top of that, we're looking at the opportunity to make sure that we have enough for the future. And the idea that we could do both and balance that is really something that I want you to, for a moment, let marinate. I want you to just hold that towards the end of the year as something that is very important. It's really the ultimate way of living. If you could do everything that you want to do now, buy what you want, go where you want, eat where you want, do what you want, and not have a crimp, and at the same time, have enough money for the future you where you're going to be able to save money so that you can enjoy your life and not worry about, oh my gosh, I got to sell the house. I got to move in with my kids. I got to worry about where I'm going to get my next money because Social Security is not going to be enough and that's all I have. Well, that balance, spending now, saving for later, making your money work for you as hard as it can is what you want to do. So here's what I'm doing now. Here's the lowdown. I'm sending you out this message before the year end. Get your money working. Get your money working. Get your money working now. Your money needs to work hard, so you don't have to. I'm sure you've thought of this before. You get your hard-earned money working. You got some investments that you think may or may not be good. You don't know. Man, you need to make sure that that money is working as hard as it can for you and as hard as you work for your money. That's the recipe for a successful future, part of a recipe for a successful future. I want you to get that right. I want you to make sure that you are in line with making sure that your future you is going to be happy with your current you. You don't want to be looking back a number of years from now and saying, oh, that 2024 Andrew was such a putz. He didn't save. He didn't do what he was supposed to be doing here. He didn't optimize investments. He didn't make my money work for me as hard as I can. So the current you or the future you is just sitting there in a pickle. Don't let that happen to you. It's not too late and it's not too early. It's not too late, but it's never too early. And it's never too late. So make sure you get on that. It's the end of the year. It's the time we need to start thinking about that and doing that. So get off your butts if you've been procrastinating and make sure to get some good advice. If you want, I'll help you also. We can, that's part of course, the process here. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Send us a note, you know, contact us. Say, hey, I want some help. Very easy. And we'll just look at what you're doing and make sure you're in the right place for where you need to be. And if you are, we're going to tell you that too. Easy enough. Easy enough. With all that, we have a pretty interesting fella coming on. So I thought we would get right on with that right now. And our guest today is John Pugliano. He's the host of Wellsteading Podcast and the author of The Robots Are Coming, A Human's Survival Guide to Profiting in the Age of Automation. John, how are you?
Andrew, great to be back on.
Thanks, it's been a while. You know, you wrote that book back in 2017. And back in 2017, right. I bet you people were like, oh, come on. And by the way, I want to right off the bat for our listeners, I want to mention something. There are a few books with the same name. The Several. Robots Are Coming. But make sure get John's book.
That's the best. Yeah, my book is definitely the best.
Yep, which the subtitle is A Human Survival Guide to Profiting in the Age of Automation. And look at his name, because when you look it up, I found three books with The Robots Are Coming. Some are comic books and things like that, but you know, and scary novels, and some are more serious. But nonetheless, you wrote that back in 2017. Now, back in 2017, I bet you, probably 1967, people were thinking, oh, the robots are coming of some way, right? You know, think of Lost in Space and, you know, Warning, Will Robinson. And then we kind of advance it, and we saw probably a number of years ago the Boston Scientific dogs that were crawling around and creeping out, and then the fake robots that most recently Elon Musk put on stage that were actually being controlled by somebody else. They were robots, but being controlled. What did you think of? Give me a taste of what you saw from robots, and they didn't have to be like real robots, but the concept in 2017, and then please bridge it over to what has changed and what's different now.
Sure. And a couple things about that. One, so I wrote the book in 16, right? Wasn't published till 17. So this was on my mind a long time ago. Robots really wasn't my focus. The publisher wanted that title, so we had to make it more robots. They liked that. I personally, my whole concept of it is it's automation, right? And really beyond automation, digitization. I've been living that all my life. So robots are just a part of it, right? They're an application of it that the media likes to talk about. But it's been the digitization of the economy. Technology, the bottom line on technology is it reduces variable cost, right? So you think 30 years ago, if you published a book, you had to write it, then you had to have it printed, and it had to get sold. So that's everything from cutting down trees to making the paper, all the ink used to print it. Then it had to get sold and distributed in brick and mortar retail stores. Today, you write a book, you can publish it in Kindle or a PDF, you wipe out not only the distribution chain, but you don't need any of that, upstream part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it drastically reduces the cost. That means the author, especially if they even self-publish, they take out all that extra incremental cost. And that's what technology does, right? Whether it's the invention of fire or electricity, you know, throughout humanity, we're always improving the human condition as technology is making it easier for humans to exist.
But what you're really saying now, this is a bigger point right here. The bigger point is technology automation is deflationary, theoretically.
It is. And unfortunately, you know, our government and our politicians, they just seem to spend even more. if we didn't have the devaluation of the dollar and all the debt, the excess spending, I really think prices would have been going down for the last 40 years.
You know, what's interesting is that the ever-changing is ever-changing, right? I mean, that's the point, right? You know, as we change more in different ways, spread out. But the automation that we're seeing these days, you're right. For example, you didn't mention the other point. The other point is if you want to write a book, or let's not say a book, let's say a paper. In theory, the cost factors for us on the back end of this, I'm not talking about the actual cost, but ChatGPT or the Google or Microsoft or pick your poison, whatever you want to use as an AI assistant, right? As a generative AI, you could pretty much point in. I'll tell you, for my DH Unplugged podcast, talk about saving money and deflationary. So instead of having an artist for the last few months and through the end of the year, I said, you know what? Instead of having an artist doing any kind of album art, we're just going to plug in five or six phrases into each episode, and the album cover art for that particular episode, we're going to have generated by ChatGPT. and it comes out, you know, is it what I want? It's close. You know, it takes two tries maybe. But think about that. How much would it cost, even if you go Fiverr or something cheap, for a album art back and forth a few times, right, to somebody? Could we say I'm being stupidly cheap? $50, $100 to somebody in India or somewhere, right?
Right.
It's the cost to me on the back end of it is zero. So you have 6 months, you know, you're talking about 20 times, it's $2,500 theoretically saved out of some poor artist's pocket, unfortunately, if you desire that kind of thing. Now, bridge that to a quick two-page discussion of, please tell me, in our business, the best stocks in the last month, how they did, what their earnings were, blah, blah, blah. It would spit out a whole thing. How long would that take an analyst to do?
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's the point I made in the book. And that's what we're seeing now. And I don't know if the pandemic either sped it up or slowed it down. That's the part I haven't quite figured out yet as I keep looking back because I changed my mind on it. But the point I made in my book was that through my lifetime, I had seen data become free, right? So, you know, when I was a kid, I was an adult. We had, phone books. We had Thomas registers. Remember in business?
Oh, register, yeah.
That to look people up at a Thomas register, all that stuff.
The D&B cards hard, too.
Everything, right? Hard copy. I mean, I remember the first time I got my first CD-ROM that had investing data on it, like you're talking about. I mean, I was thrilled. I used to have to go to like the library and look up Value Line and, three-ring binder stuff. So over the last 30 years, data has become free, right? You still maybe have to pay for the Wall Street Journal or, New York Times, but almost all subscriptions have gone away in those terms. Now we're at the point, again, this is what I made in the book, labor will become free. Digitization first made data free, freer, cheaper, lower cost.
Right.
Now we're coming to the point where labor will become less expensive, freer, cheaper. And again, not the robots or what the media everybody wants to emphasize on, but it's exactly what you talked about. If you're a graphic artist, if you're a copywriter, if you're a legal researcher, that's all being replaced by artificial intelligence. And that's real, that's active, that's happening. And that's going to, just like desktop publishing, back in the 80s, I guess, late 80s, started to creep in and replace digitization. Time Magazine was still a big thing in 1985, but digital, desktop publishing was starting to come in. That's where we are today, I think.
And to some degree is, if you remember, there was a copy boy, a copy clerk, there was a receptionist. Like, who needs a receptionist anymore? Now, it took a little while for people to be like, oh, I'm not answering my own phone. What would that look like? Oh my God. Call. Direct dial to my extension through Ring Central. I can text, record, talk, video conference, everything through that one app. And it all goes back to Salesforce and records. So therefore there's the pressure in the system, the need to have multi layers of cost factors has been eliminated and is very acceptable today.
Yes. And again, we're in that early stages of digitization that we saw in publishing, and look what's happened today, right? From publishing in the 80s or 90s to where we are today, an entire industries went away. That printing the phone book, that was like a $1 billion industry from the forest to the distribution center, right? That took out a $1 billion industry. We're going to see that continue on the labor markets over the next, 20 years.
There's not even any yellow pages anymore. I mean, there's just not.
No yellow pages. My youngest kid is, she's still like 25 or something now. But a couple of years ago, someone threw like a yellow pages at her front door and she's like, what is this?
Right.
I told her what it was. She thought I was joking.
Told her it was a booster seat for her kid, right?
Exactly.
Didn't that what used to be at the table? Hey, Johnny can't sit. Get him the phone book. Get him a phone book. You get two, pile them up and he sat right up on him. That's what I used to set up as a kid.
Absolutely. Those things, though, that's the impact in the economy. And I'm cynically optimistic. I know a lot of people are pessimistic. The point of my book was surviving and thriving in the automation that's coming, because while I think it is going to replace a lot of jobs, especially mid-level manager jobs, those kind of things, these lower end research or less creative type jobs, I think they are going away. But it also opens it up, and you know, guys like me and you, what we're doing right now, we couldn't have done even 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Talking on a Zoom conference,
right.
self-publishing our own, basically radio programs.
Right, exactly.
You had to be 30 years ago. You had to be a Rush Limbaugh.
Or I remember. I cut my teeth. I cut my teeth at the radio station.
Right?
Yeah, no, I cut my teeth at the radio station.
Right? Sure.
Yeah.
You had to do that. Today, anybody can grab a microphone, get on TikTok, get on YouTube, whatever. And that's so to me, I think it's fascinating. But this, this is what we're seeing. I think with the discontent in the political systems, whether they be in the US or in Europe or around the world, and it's a symptom of our economy that's changing and shifting. But I'm frankly very optimistic about it.
I will tell you though, just on one note of this. It's great when we talk about the ability and for anyone to possibly and have the opportunity to do X, Y, Z. At the same time, I'm not so thrilled that anybody can get on a microphone and say anything they want to say. I'm not all in favor. I'm in favor of free speech, but there's sometimes a little bit too much, not of free speech, but of silliness being talked about. Not everybody should be a financial talk show host.
Sure. That's where I think again, AI, artificial intelligence things hasn't caught up where, you'll remember when browsers first came out and you were getting, and then people figured out you could advertise on them. So you got spam constantly. And then someone came up with an ad blocker and, you'll be able to edit what you see and hear easier in the future.
Weird question just came to me. Does 411 still operate? Do you know?
I have no idea.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
No idea. Yeah, sure. Yeah,
you call up, hey, 411, can you give me the number of John Pugliano? And I think he's in somewhere on the West Coast. All right, we got one here. Yeah, that's the one. I'll take that. And then if you ask for a second one, I think they charge you a second fee for it. I don't even know if that's available. Some people are out there going, what are they talking about?
Yeah.
What is that?
But this stuff's all getting so great and talking about other things that you don't need any more translators, right? I was in Europe a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
I'm in the middle of nowhere. I'm talking to some cab driver, different people on the street, and we're just talking into my cell phone using, Google Translate.
Yeah, we need the universal translator that they used to have on Star Trek.
We're pretty close.
You put that on and just everybody sounds, they're talking in your language with some weird looking head.
Right. Right. Literally, that's what it was though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking into my cell phone in English, and whether I was in Spain or Italy, it was spitting it out. The cab driver's talking back in his language. It comes out in English.
Perfect.
To me.
Love it.
I mean, it's fantastic.
Estimates are that 47% of existing jobs are at risk of being automated or rendered obsolete by other technology changes in the next 20 years. That's something you go along with?
I think so. Somewhere around there.
So,
My grandfather was a coal miner. My other grandfather was a railroader. I'm glad I don't have to do those jobs. I'm glad I'm not going to die of black lung. Right. I mean,
right.
I'm almost as old as my grandfather when he died because he had black lung from working in the coal mine.
Oh boy.
So, again, getting back to my book, a point I make in it is, and I don't say that. I hate authors, right? I wrote the book so long ago. I don't even know if I still get, royalties on it. I just bring this up to say that these are not new ideas. These are things that have been progressing. But, I said in that book that it comes down to creativity. I've got a 3D printer, so I can do all kinds of amazing things with that 3D printer. But you know what? Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo could still blow me away.
Yes.
Right? Using that 3D printer. Right. Technology, it not only reduces incremental cost, it's a tool that helps us go beyond what we can do.
I guess the point you're making is just because you have a paintbrush does not mean you can paint.
Absolutely. And right. Like you said about, just because you have a microphone doesn't mean that you can give financial advice.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I agree. Wealth steading. You have the podcast called Wealth Steading. Now I keep saying the word wealth steading because I want people then to understand what you're about to tell me is what is wealth steading?
Wealth steading to me is a concept. If I got a lot of friends that are preppers and homesteaders and things like that, to me, wealth steading is a modern version of homesteading. You know, again, my grandparents, they used to have to grow all their own food and preserve it and do those things. I didn't want to work that hard, right? I wanted to take advantage of digitization and technology. So I learned to live off of my assets instead of, you know, living off of the land, so to speak. So to me, wealth setting is just that holistic concept, modern day, using our money to grow our wealth and live off of.
Yeah, good stuff. So in our discussion prior to this, let's get into the market discussion and the forward look on things. Because I think I could say that from our discussions, I mean, you're generally, I think you're bullish on the next several years, and you have some reasons why. I mean, you're to a point, I don't think, changed anything recently, and you're pretty much thinking that post-election economy are there's some good things to be thinking about moving forward.
I think there are, and I thought that whether it was going to be a Trump or Harris win, it didn't matter to me, or even a Biden before, you know, Biden dropped out. I have not changed my portfolio drastically leading up to the election, haven't done anything since the election, you know, other than just taking advantage of some things that are moving up and down. But I have been for a long time optimistic specifically about North America. I'm not so excited about the rest of the world, but North America, and in particular, United States. I think, again, premise of that book that I wrote in 2016, I think it can be a continuation of the American bull market that we've had for the last 40 years. I think that could continue.
I mean, there's things that you mentioned here, right? That there is discontent with the status quo around the world, which is what, you know, populism. I find it to be a weird word to describe the people that are coming in, right? Don't you? Or am I wrong? I've never really been able to synchronize the thought of some of these leaders that come in and say, "Oh, it's you know, it's populism." It's I mean, how does that square? It's more of the way I would see it is a out with the old, in with the new, or change. Now, how about this? Change, total change of what was to something different.
I think populism is one of those words where, you know, when the ruling party gets what they want at the ballot box, they call it democracy. When they lose, they call it populism.
Yeah.
Because they were replaced by somebody else.
But right.
It's called different things too. I mean, you know, a lot of the press is calling the rise of the far right in a lot of Europe. But you know, you look at Britain, they put in a Labour government, and they still have the same issues pretty much that Brexit was concerned about, you know, stagnating economy, just loss of jobs to overseas, cheap Chinese imports, what they think, you know, excessive immigration. These are kind of problems that you see in most of the Western world, including, I mean, you see similar, different but similar problems in South Korea or Japan. A lot of it comes back to, again, point I made in the book, demographics. A lot of this, the deflationary pressures we're seeing from technology are being offset by the government spending. They're also being offset by demographics, because as the baby boomers retire and die, labor costs are skyrocketing. And that's one of those things that definitely was advanced by the pandemic. That really showed us how quickly the boomers are retiring. Yeah. And we've had a huge increase in inflation because of that, which hasn't been able to be offset yet by technology.
Yeah. One of the things you have to be, if you're bullish or if you're hopeful or if you're looking at and centric to North America, US, you need to realize, I think you'd probably agree with me, that most areas around the world don't create anything, but they consume, right? We want the consumption. We want those other economies doing well because we want them to consume our fill in the blank. Whether it's our products that we either manufacture or that we design or that we create or the technology that we have, doesn't matter. Who cares, right? It's like, or the medicine that we then create. I mean, you know, where is the creation of medicine? There's a couple of small spots in Europe, Israel, United States. Forget about Canada. Name me a Canadian product that's like, wow. And don't say maple syrup.
Yeah. I think Shopify comes out of Canada, which is about the only thing that isn't a commodity, right? It isn't lumber and it isn't raw material.
But that's it. Carnitzel, I'll take that. A little bit of smoked meat.
So, what we've seen over the last 40 years has been that globalization where the design comes from the United States or Europe, and design, whether it's, you know, Nike tennis shoes or whether it's some kind of pharmaceutical, like you're talking about with medical things, it's designed in the U.S. and used to be made here, used to be made in Europe. Over these last 30, 40 years, most of that has migrated to initially Asia broadly and, you know, specifically now India and China. And again, I think that's where a lot of where that backlash or the populism, the discontent with governments and politicians is that the workers that used to make those products are no longer here in the United States. Yeah, we're still designing them here, but the blue collar workers, whatever you want to call them, you know, the workforce is no longer here.
Well, there is no part of that because nobody wants to do it. They don't want to do it. Who wants to work for $3 an hour? No air conditioning and no benefits. I'll tell you who: people in China and Vietnam.
Exactly. And again, I think that's where the automation comes in. Though these factories are not going to be filled with people; they're going to be filled with machines and robots and different types of automation that are still going to need tended to by human beings.
Exactly.
And so again, that's where I think these jobs are going to be replaced.
Yeah.
But a lot of these jobs are going to be replaced in Asia, coming back to the United States, as well as the mid-level managers in the U.S. We won't need as many of them, but we'll still need skill. Lynn, if you can crack a bead with an arc welder, you can get employed now. And you're not going to be working in a factory making cars, because they replaced those welders 30 years ago with robotics. But if you're going to do a pipeline or any type of infrastructure, pretty much you need a welder on site. Automation works great for things that are routine and predictable, but when a lightning strike, hits some power supply in a mountain in Utah, you need to get a human out there and fix it. A squirrel chews through some wires in Manhattan,
right?
A rat or something chews through wires in Manhattan. You need a human in there to fix
Somebody needs to make,
So that's where I'm bullish on those kind of things.
I'm going to take a quick break, but when we get back, I want to talk to you about your comparison of some of the policies that Trump is making and that to a specific president and what happened during his tenure, his presidency, his reign, if you will, with the stock market, which is, I think, pretty surprising. So we'll be right back. Hang on. I want to talk about Interactive Brokers. Are you ready to chart your path to financial independence? Well, you can get started with Portfolio Analyst by Interactive Brokers and consolidate, track, and analyze all of your financial accounts on a single powerful dashboard. And the best part? Well, it's free for everyone. You don't need an IBKR account to get started. It's not required. Plan for your future with their new retirement planner, tailored to your preferences and market assumptions. Unlock deep portfolio insights and comprehensive risk assessments. You can drill into specific metrics like portfolio holdings and allocations, performance, and you can track your performance against over 300 benchmarks. Plus, you can manage your portfolios confidently with GIPS verified returns. Sign up for Portfolio Analyst for free at ibkr.com/freepa. That's again, ibkr.com/freepa. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. We're back with John Pugliano, host of Wealth Standing Podcast, which you got to go check out. We'll have all the information on actually how to get to his podcast on the episode show notes for show number 898 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We left off a little tease on your thoughts on what the policies and impact can be. And there's two different presidents that you looked at in comparisons. Take me through some of that.
Yeah. One of the reasons I'm optimistic about the future, and again, I would have been this way, whether it was Harris, Trump, whoever, because I think there are long-term trends. One of those long-term trends is Trump himself, right? And maybe not so much the person Trump, but the personality that he's created and what he's been able to latch onto. And that's why I think he won this time. It's why I think he won in 2016. 2016 is when the Brexit took place, right? So it's same similar kind of discontent in Europe. And it has to do with all the things we talked about. Trump, though, is a trend in himself. But the three big trends that were going to be happening, no matter who was president, are in place, and I think they would benefit the U.S. economy one way or the other. Trump, though, I think has some unique ways to leverage those. And I'll tell you, of all the presidents I look back, a lot of people say, "Oh, Trump, he's like Reagan. You know, Reagan-esque. He cuts taxes. He wants deregulation." Yeah, that's all true. But I think Trump and Clinton are really the most comparable presidents. And for people that Republicans that don't like Clinton, let me tell you something. Post-World War II, and maybe forever, but post-World War II, Clinton has the best annual rate of return in the S&P 500 of any president.
Over an eight-year term.
Over an eight-year term, if you annualize it, just take an annual thing, and I think it's 15.3% or something.
And by the way,
annualized rate of return.
What was the?
And I didn't vote for Clinton, by the way. I didn't vote for him twice, right? I'm not saying I love Clinton. I'm just telling you, looking at the facts, Clinton has the best presidency. And
what was his deficit? What again? If I recall, I think he cut it.
I think he was also, other than maybe Eisenhower, he was the only president in modern times to have had a balanced budget at some point. Mm-hmm. I think that was less about Clinton, though, and more about when he lost the midterms to Newt Gingrich and those guys, and they forced him to have a balanced budget too. Yeah. But again, so we'll talk about three main things here that those things that worked out for Clinton, I think, can work out favorably for Trump as well. And I mean, to that point, why did they balance the budget in, I guess it was 96 or something, 94, somewhere around there? Well, the Cold War ended in 91. So we had what was called a peace dividend back then, right? We didn't have to spend as much on defense. And at the same time, globalization was really kicking off because, you know, you and I remember, Andrew, they used to have the free world and used to have the Soviet bloc or the, mm-hmm. you know, the communist world, whatever you want to call it, and the third world. Everything was broke up. And basically, it was very bipolar. U.S. and allies controlled half the world. Soviet Union controlled the other half. After 91, when the Soviet Union dissolved, the global economy opened up. And so you not only had less money you had to spend on defense, you could also sell to more people, more countries, more exports. So Clinton hugely benefited from globalization. Well, right now it's, and these comparisons to Clinton, some of them are exact opposites. While we were at the beginning of globalization in Clinton's time because of the end of the Cold War, now we've hit, I think, peak globalization, which happened during the pandemic. And this is the start of the new Cold War. And so we're either in Cold War II or some people are calling it a hot peace. And,
you know, I like it.
Hot peace, right? It gets back to, you know, we had mutually assured destruction with the Soviets. We couldn't nuke each other because it would destroy the world. I think the hot peace side of it is the same with China. We can't blow up the economy, you know, because it'd be mutually assured destruction. They need us, we need them. So we can't totally de-link, but there's going to be a lot of—
That was always the talk about the treasuries and why do they own it? Why are they not selling it? And how come they own it? Why don't they hurt us? We're too interrelated. And even if we want to unravel all that, it would be next to impossible. I just don't see it happening.
And so that's the hot piece, right? It's just an ugly divorce. It's an ugly divorce with joint custody of the economy. What it's going to be.
Right.
But just like there was advantages to globalization that really helped the Clinton economy, I think there's advantages to deglobalization or peak globalization that Trump is going to benefit from. And that's the reindustrialization of the U.S., which, again, correlates to what we've been talking about, you know, with the whole thing about technology. These low-cost jobs that went to Asia over the last 30, 40 years, many of them are coming back because we saw during the pandemic supply chain issues, the transportation disruptions, all those problems. Well, we also now have automation to where we can start making some things easier, more effectively, and cheaper here in the U.S. We have much lower energy costs. So things like, you know, natural gas is still pretty much a waste product. You know, we're liquefying that and sending it out to Europe and other places now, but there's still plenty of oil rigs that are flaring off natural gas. That is all going to be used for US industrialization. Mm-hmm. And when you factor in the national defense aspect of it, where we've finally concluded that, you know, again, training with our enemies doesn't make them our friends. It just makes them stronger. So we're seeing those things where, again, during the Cold War, we opened up the world. A large part of what happened through the second term of Bill Clinton and then into the 2000s was, you know, all the military things got released to civilian world. So we could use satellites for GPS. We could use, you know, the internet came about from DARPA initially, right? So all that.
I thought his vice president created it.
Yeah, Al Gore created the internet, right? All that stuff became commercializable and profitable, which drove the economy for the next 30 years. Now we're seeing the other side of that, though, where we had that Sputnik moment where we realized that the Chinese are going into space. The Chinese are, you know, beating us in solar panels and electric vehicles and things. So we're limiting the things that we export to the rest of the world, specifically China. And I think we'll see that in India too. We're not letting them have the best chips, the highest speed semiconductors. That's going to help the U.S. because we do design it here. We do have it here. So we went from strategic trade to now being strategic competition. And we're going to specifically, you know, hinder other people from competing against us. Again, good for maybe not good for global economy. I think it's going to be good for the United States economy.
Right. I mean, globalization, the concept, the construct is still very important. The idea, this misnomer that somehow, oh, we'll bring jobs back. Okay. There'll be jobs that will be brought back, like there always is, depending on what we're doing. There are certain jobs that are not coming back. I am telling you, we will not have sweatshops here. And
no.
Yet we want to buy cheap underwear and t-shirts.
Right. Sure. But we have those dark factories, right? The sweatshops are now replaced by dark factories. We're going to have these data centers, right? They're multi-billion dollar investments, but hardly any people work there. The sweat's going to be done by the electrons and the robots and things, but you'll need people to support those. So that gets in that next trend, right? The other thing that really, and we talked about this the whole first section, is that digitization of the economy that really started under Bill Clinton. Once we didn't have to use all those things for military applications, they came in. We started to digitize the easiest part, which was things like printing and publishing. Data started becoming cheaper, and you really had computers at that point, but you didn't have the internet. So under the second term of Clinton is when we really started to see the computers and internet merging. That's just really what drove, you know, massive. It drove the internet bubble, right? Of the dot-com bubble 2000. But Clinton's stock market benefited from that because he was out before the bubble came. We're seeing that same thing. I do think that Trump can benefit from, which is the merging technologies of the internet of things is finally kicking in. We're really getting things that communicate and talk with each other on things like 5G. And then you add in large language models and automation and robotics to all that. And we do get to the point where, you know, we are seeing those lower, I don't want to say lower skilled, but the lower tiered creative jobs are going away. You don't need the copyright editor. You don't need a graphic designer as much anymore. We're replacing those. And so that is going to help drive productivity. And again, I think we're already seeing it in the stock market, but that could definitely help.
About the people that are displaced from this? I mean, this is the elephant in the room, the discussion that's not even happened, right? There's this discussion that, oh, don't worry, because it creates new jobs. Well,
it doesn't. What I also think is being balanced, kind of like we talked about the deflation of inflation being balanced by the overspending of government, where if we didn't have the baby boomers retiring, I think we would be in trouble maybe from some of this automation, but we have so many baby boomer jobs that we need to replace that I think there will be not as much of massive unemployment as there would have been. Again, specifically in the United States, I think, look at China, right? I don't think they publish their youth unemployment anymore, but what is it? 25% youth unemployment,
which is unbelievable.
Which is unbelievable.
That's a large number.
Yeah, massively. And that's not only their low end.
That's probably the entire East Coast and West Coast of the United States not working.
Sure, sure. And it isn't even just their low labor people, right? All their guys that went and got engineering degrees and things over the last decade, they're finding it hard to get jobs as well. So yeah, I think unemployment's going to hit other people worse than the United States. Again, because we have the baby boomers in retirement, which is going to be another positive advantage too. I'll only give a teaser on that. I know you've probably talked about it as well. You know, the boomers control about $78 trillion in assets. Mm-hmm. So they're all going to be gone in the next 20, 25 years. You know, all that money is going to get
money transfer.
And you know, between the next 5 to 10 years, 20 years, it's going to get spent by them on healthcare and discretionary spending. And when they die, it's going to get inherited by their kids and grandkids. And I think a lot of it's just going to get spent. Yeah, so again, something to help promote the economy over these next 4 years. I think it's going to happen. It has happened.
Well, it hasn't been a bad 4 years to begin with. Yes, we had some things happen. Where are we now? 24 to 25. So we're on the tail end of the 4 year period of COVID, which turned out, by the way, to be a boon. You know, I don't know if AI would have been here so fast without it. I don't know if some of the technology that we had, some of the things, like I said, you know, I can have a phone app that allows me to either have the office on my little bitty iPhone, my whole office technically. You can't do everything on that, but, you know, you have the communications ability on that. And then everything route and then be backed up, be synchronized. Without even thinking about, you don't think about it. The old days, you're like, okay, I got to synchronize this, I got to get that, got to go. You don't even have to do that anymore. It's fabulous.
Yeah, and the pandemic too, it really disrupted that supply chain. It woke people up to the fact that, you know, just in time delivery isn't maybe such a good thing. And so I think that's what's driven a lot here too. I'll tell you one more big thing, comparison between Clinton and Trump, and this is short term. I think this can really energize the stock market over the next, say, 2 years. And that's, you know, Clinton really benefited from tax cuts and deregulation, not necessarily that he did, but they had been in place from the previous 12 years. So, you know, all the long and variable lags from the Reagan era of cutting taxes and deregulating, that really started to pay dividends by the time Bill Clinton got into office, especially the deregulation side of it. So that was a huge boon to his economy, and he could take advantage of it without having to necessarily support it. So he could, you know, kind of play both sides of the political spectrum with that. Trump is coming in. He's inheriting basically 8 years of his own tax cuts that he first put in, you know, 8 years ago. But what's more important, regardless of whether he specifically deregulates or not, which I think he's going to, they overturned the Chevron doctrine. The Supreme Court did that earlier this year. I think that's going to open up a lot of deregulation that would have happened whether Harris or Trump was in, because private businesses are going to, you know, go back and reopen old cases using the Chevron doctrine. And the other part that, again, I think would have even benefited Harris is that Biden has been the most antitrust enforcer that I think we've seen since.
Oh, Lena Khan has been brutal.
Oh yeah, since, you know, Roosevelt, right? And this is so just out the gate without the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, going after people. I think the next 1 to 2 years, I mean, just the pent up mergers and acquisitions, I think that could really rock the stock market higher. I mean, what did they do? They stopped Tapestry and Capri from merging because they're worried about the price of handbags.
I mean, they stopped JetBlue from buying Spirit Airlines, okay, because they wanted to ensure there was low price competition. By doing so, basically put Spirit Airlines into bankruptcy. All they did was screw the shareholders and the bondholders. And if in fact it went to its full course and Spirit didn't exist, it would have created even less competition. Where was the wisdom in that?
It's ridiculous.
I mean, but
that's gone away. That, I think that is done. So I think that alone could give us, obviously there's going to be bumps along the road. There's a lot of things that could happen, but I do think that alone, that antitrust stuff going away, is going to really help not only the large caps, but the small cap stocks in particular.
The small caps, a lot of the financials in particular that are usually under the radar, some of the energy companies as well, even though they may be the drill baby drill and the, you know, oil price is supposedly going to go down. The opportunity for some of the refiners and other parts of that small cap universe that have really benefit from deregulation. I agree. And the stock market is starting to show that too. They're starting feel around that.
So I think those three things were, they were long-term trends in place, no matter who won the election. I think Trump can definitely, just with his personality and the way he does things, I think he's smart enough to latch onto those. And we could see a really good 4 years. I'll tell you, there's some problems though. On the other hand,
I think it's important to do so because let's be honest. I mean, we're walking into a situation with a debt overhang that's just unbelievable. It's backbreaking. And of course, we're walking into a highly valuated stock market rather than a low base. But you continue.
Yeah, absolutely. We have high valuations on the market. I'm a little less concerned about that because if the growth really pans out, then I think that, you know, the peg on the PEG works out okay. But that's an issue. The debt is insurmountable. I think we'll have to inflate our way out of that. Another aspect of the debt is probably half of that is owed to the government itself anyways. So there's some smoke and mirrors there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you owe trillions and trillions to the Social Security Trust Fund, do you really owe anything because it's just yourself anyways? I think they're going to print their way out of all that.
Yeah, that's like saying to your wife, hey, can I borrow $1,000 and saying that I have to pay her back?
Exactly. It's so some of that smoke and mirrors, not that it's not a problem, but it's not as bad as I think people think. But it also isn't probably going to get any better. I don't see Trump reducing the deficit. But I think the big problems, and again, could have happened no matter who's president, but because, you know, Biden never got rid of Trump's tariffs. And in fact, he doubled down, right? He put in more trade sanctions and things against the Chinese. So that was a continuing trend anyways, as part of that whole national defense and Cold War II that we're in. But if you remember, you know, what probably started the Great Depression, it was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. So I think as we put on these tariffs, that could create a global depression possibly, or at least a major recession. Europe certainly is practically in recession as it is now anyways. The other thing, these sanctions we're putting on, and not only Russia, but we're putting it on China. I think we might see some go on India and other places. You know, it was oil sanctions on the Japanese that probably led to the attack on Pearl Harbor. So there are these tit for tats where we could find ourselves in some, maybe not just hot peace, but we do get into a hot war. And then finally, the Federal Reserve, you know, talking about the deficit, Federal Reserve all of a sudden isn't so interested about cutting interest rates, are they? I mean, which is funny because last time you and I talked in January, the market was pricing in six rate cuts.
That was
we were saying BS, right? Oof. And here we are. We're almost the end of the year. We might get one more in, but with two or three this year, the market was saying six. The Federal Reserve is no friend of Trump's, and again, he's not going to cut the deficit. So if his policies are inflationary, then the Fed's gonna step raise up. Interest rates. So we've seen, you know, we're back up to what, 4.3% or so on the 10-year mortgage. Rates are up, getting close to 7 again. So,
and the idea that his policies are deflationary is not so. So there is that. It's going to be an interesting struggle. They're already backpedaling. So we'll see how that goes into the end of the year. And then, of course, it seems to me that the Fed is setting the ground for, hey, we're pausing here. We're not going to be stupid, but we'll see what happens. John Pugliano, host of the Wealth Setting Podcast, author of The Robots Are Coming, A Human's Survival Guide to Profiting in the Age of Automation. Thank you so much. Have a great new year, and I'll see you on the backside into 2025.
Andrew, appreciate it. Always a pleasure to come on.
All right, buddy. Thanks. And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're entering into the last few weeks of the year, that Santa Claus rally. We're going to see if it actually appears or not. But in the meantime, like I said earlier on in the show, I'm going to really stick this to you over the next few episodes. I want you to make sure that you are set and you are making sure that your money is working as hard for you as you are working for it. Make sure to go over the Disciplined Investor. See all that we have to offer as well on the various podcasts that show up there. DH Unplugged is linked there, as well as links to all the places that you can get this podcast on Amazon Music, on YouTube, on Apple Podcasts, also on Spotify. And I'll see you again next week with another great guest and another great discussion. Thanks so much for being there. Thanks so much for your support. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you again. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.